Hi, this is Danny Hutton of Three Dog Night.
And Corey Wells of Three Dog Night.
And we're in the studio.
This is Redbeard in the studio. When Emil Lewandowski of Buffalo, New York, died last week at age 74 from complications while undergoing cancer treatment, he was known by family and friends as a loving husband for 51 years, as well as a grandfather who would rather fish than do just about anything else, except sing as Corey Wells in the L.A.-based legendary music group Three Dog Night. Between 1968 and the mid-70s, it was impossible to turn on an American radio without hearing one of Three Dog Night's 21 hit singles, half of which went top 10. As obviously talented as they were in performing live and recording, possibly the greatest contribution long-term by Corey Wells, tenor Danny Hutton, and former member Chuck Negron was their impeccable choices of songs by then-unknown songwriters to record, including Harry Nilsson, Randy Newman, the late Laura Nyro, and Hoyt Axton. Here is my 2005 interview with Corey Wells and Danny Hutton of Three Dog Night in the studio.
Danny, where were you actually born?
I was born in Buncrana, Ireland, during the Second World War.
Buncrana Island.
Yeah, that's the northern part of Ireland, but on the Republic side, about 12 miles from Londonderry.
Wow.
Or as they say in the Republic side, Derry.
In Derry. So how did your family come to emigrate to the U.S., and where did you all settle?
Well, my mother was the last one. There was a bunch of brothers and sisters. And she was the youngest, and my grandmother was an invalid, so she kind of was the last one, and my grandmother died. And my Uncle Eddie finally got the money and, you know, went through all of the legal stuff. And my mother, my brother and sister, and I came over. My father had joined the English Army during the war and didn't come back.
Oh,
so,
wow.
He did years later. My sister actually went and caught him, found him. and we had it was fine once he came back when I was about 16. So, and we went to Boston like all the Irish people.
Right,
we just lived down in the poor section of Boston, down in the South End.
Corey, where were you born and raised, and I'm told still live to this day?
Yeah, I was born in Buffalo, New York, and I commute back and forth in the seasons back to Los Angeles, right, where I still have my family. My daughters are still living there.
Oh, cool. The question is, you know, old Danny boy, how did Emil Lewandowski of Buffalo, New York meet Danny Hutton of Buncrana, Ireland, and Chuck Negron from the Bronx? How did this happen and all come together in L.A.?
Actually, it's... everybody does come to L.A., especially in the 60s. Everybody came out to do the music, so it's not as unnatural sounding as it seems. We were all in the business, and I met Corey on a tour. It was a Sonny and Cher tour. But what did Dick Clark do that tour? It's kind of a Dick Clark, Sonny and Cher tour headlining, but I think it was kind of a Dick Clark promotion tour, one of those. We were on a bus together. Sonny and Cher flew and would meet us at the gigs. That was in 65, and that's where we really kind of hooked up. I think we might have met through friends and managers at the Whiskey. We might have said hello, but I think that's when we kind of bonded.
I was one of the guys that commuted. There was only two places you could go, and that was either New York City or you went to Los Angeles. It just so happened that the guitar player's brother-in-law was a actor and wanted to get back to Los Angeles, back to his acting, and saw this as a vehicle in order to get him back there, and which was the guitar player, his brother-in-law, and another guy, and myself. And we did come back to Los Angeles with promises of working at a place called Panza's Lazy Susan, which was a piano bar and didn't want rock and roll bands there. So I was sort of stranded in Los Angeles and either sink or swim, and I ended up doing that.
I'd moved there when I was 13. My mother and I left from Boston My brother was in the Army. My sister was in the Aquacades. She was in Europe. One of those, you know, the swimming water ballet things.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. David Rose, I forget what it was. Johnny Weissmuller was the star of the show.
Wow.
And so we just took a train. She had $500, and we just sat up in the train all the way to L.A., and that was my entrance in L.A. at the beautiful, it was still a beautiful station, the Union Station. Yeah, so I was kind of a Hollywood guy from about the age of 13.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Time has been very kind in validating your choices in two key areas on those first four studio albums, and that's been your impeccable choices in material to sing and your original band members. Now, on the first album, who found a song by a writer named Harry Nilsson called One?
Well, there's like that movie Rashomon. I hear all these different things. Well, I'll tell you, my memory is being at Gabriel Mechler, our first producer's house, and him playing that song for me. And I thought it was, you know, I thought it was okay. And that's when I first heard it. And then I think he presented it to us later at a session. But he also said, hey, come on out to there's a garage outside. He says, what do you think of this? If you can come up with any little parts to this, it's a song Steppenwolf, the bass player, came up with. And it was the riff, just the riff going, ba-dum-bum-bum-bum-bum, ba-dum-bum-bum-bum-bum. He was playing with his left hand. And I thought, what the hell is that? I don't hear a song. It was Magic Carpet Ride. It was mm-hmm. That's the two things I remember that day. But you know what? I think what helped us in this crazy way, Because we approached everything, we'd become a live performing band. So when we'd get a song, we'd like one, the arrangement on one, if it had been a regular studio band, they would have, during certain parts, said, okay, we need a Barry horns here, and here we need a violin, and they would have brought him in. But instead, we sat there going, crap, there's four of us. What are we going to do? And then Michael would say, well, you know that line there? I'll just do my fuzz, and I'll sound like a sax. Da, 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 da. And then he'd take his fuzz off, and then he'd all of a sudden hit one of the strings on his guitar and then use his volume control to sound like a violin line. So it ended up being forced to be very spare. It ended up making it interesting, I think.
Danny, you could have safely told people that you were moving a lot of records, but I'm told it was off a loading dock, not really selling them, right?
Yeah, a friend of mine, John Armstrong, his uncle worked at Disney Studios, so John got into the mailroom, and he said, hey, I think I can get you in here. So he got me in there, but he got me in across the street in the... which is now the animation building. It's a nice-looking building now, but at the time, it wasn't officially on the lot, the record warehouse. So I got a job loading and unloading trucks full of Cinderella records, you know, the LPs, Buena Vista records.
Right.
And the big hot item was Annette Funicello when she became a rock. She did rock records. But that was my... introduction, but it was also
call those rock records.
Yeah, actually, they did a song called "Monkey's Uncle" with the Beach Boys backing her up. But the good thing about it was my introduction to this crazy, weird magazine that came out every week that I'd never heard of, and most people didn't, call Billboard. Billboard came every week, and I would have never known about it. But because I worked in the record department, I just started reading it. In fact, that's where I saw this weird picture in the back in the foreign section of these crazy-looking guys called the Beatles. That was before they were on Swan, you know, when they were still just an English act.
Wow. In 1968, when the three of you had finally hooked up, it was firmly believed that every recording act had to have a distinct... marketable hook, you know, a unique angle. The Beatles certainly did. The Rolling Stones did. Cool Jimi Hendrix, The Who. They all had an approach. Now, when you formed Three Dog Night, how did you describe it in your initial meetings, pitching yourselves to record labels? I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall and hear that.
Well, we weren't pitching it to any record labels. Actually, it was just Danny and I pitching ourselves to this friend of Danny's, David Andley, and we went there with asking his advice. Should we go as a duo or should we go as a trio of singers? And he said that there already was a band called Rhinoceros at the time, and they were two lead singers in that one. That would be probably better to go with three lead singers, and that's when we set out to find a third singer, and that's how we got that together. And then it was a matter of there were a lot of things in between all that stuff. There was conflicts with me having to work and still do clubs, and neither Danny nor Chuck were.
I was working in studio. I wasn't doing live stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you weren't getting paid for it.
Yeah, I was.
Were you?
Sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. You were getting paid to do your own stuff?
Well, yeah, I was with Mercury Records with Nick Vinay. Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. Kim Fowley.
Yeah, so anyway, the bottom line is we had to work out all those logistics and things that we were doing. So
I didn't have to pay rent. That was a difference.
I knew there was something there. Yeah, there was something there.
You had to support a wife and a kid.
Yeah. So we got that working. Well, we ended up going into the studio with a band that I was working with, and we went in to cut a demo, and it was actually an old Rascals tune off the album, which was not a hit or anything. And we recorded that. And we took that and pitched that to White Whale Records, and
who had Turtles. The Turtles,
yeah,
and the Rockets, who ended up being Crazy Horse later.
Yeah, So they were ecstatic about it, and they were trying to be cool about it, but they wanted to sign us immediately. But we could pick up on the excitement, and we said, well, wait, we're just going to hold here. And by that time, we ended up meeting this gentleman by the name of Bill Utley, and he was a manager of the Turtles, wasn't he?
The Turtles, yeah, the Turtles at the time. And he also had a club. He had a hot club down in, remember? He had a club called the Rendezvous or something?
Yeah. Well, he was with Reb Foster, the old disc jockey. Anyway, so he started doing some inquiries, and then he had a shoot-off. You know, we're gonna play at the Troubadour, and he was gonna have all those companies come in, all the record companies that were interested, and to bid on us, and we would take the best offer. And that's how we ended up on Dunhill.
But there was a moment when Corey and I kind of thought about the third. Chuck was not the first guy that we actually came up with. We were thinking of not necessarily seriously, but I remember Billy Joe Royal coming into the conversation.
No kidding.
And actually, we talked to Bruce Johnston.
No kidding.
And I was thinking of Danny Whitten. I don't know if I told Corey, who ended up being a big influence on Neil Young with Crazy Horse.
Sure.
And then we actually went in with Brian Wilson. Once we auditioned Chuck at this place I had right off the freeway, and we both thought the harmony was the best with him. And then we went in and did a couple of songs with Brian Wilson at his studio, which one of them ended up being a hit for them called Darlin'. We actually did the track.
I love that song.
That's the track they use is the track that we did with Brian.
No kidding.
So that was just before what Corey was talking about when we our manager said, look, if that's not going to happen and you're not going to do a record, get out there and work. And I know Corey is he's a great live performer, so he was chomping at the bit to get out of the studio and get on the stage. So that's what we did. We played at this strange, do you remember that? Was it our first gig? We played at a
Red Velvet, you mean?
We did a little audition at the Red Velvet, but we actually went and played five songs one afternoon at a bowling alley.
Mm-hmm. Carolina Pines
at Deerport. So, but it all happened, as Corey said, we didn't really pitch that much. It all happened fairly quickly for us.
You never get away from the bomb.
ever found Laura Nyro's Eli's Coming? Because, you know, when she wrote it and when she sings it, originally, it's a cautionary tale of a woman warning another woman in the way only a woman can. So who in Three Dog Night saw that you could do a successful gender switch? I mean, that's brilliant.
Well, it was the other singer who I gave Easy to Be Hard, and he gave me that song, and only I could do it as a woman. and actually, you know, I just didn't think he had the voice for it, and he knew that, and so he gave me to do it, and I gave it my treatment with the way I would do it.
Wow. Well, with the debut album's in number 11 peak, you don't waste any time recording the follow-up, Suitable for Framing. Now, the rock musical Hair, it was spinning off songs left and right, being covered by everybody from the Fifth Dimension to the Cow Sills. How did you secure a hold on Easy to Be Hard for your second album?
Was something I'd heard on the radio. Danny and I have a mutual friend, Timmy Alvarado, who was the only guy who had a car that we knew
that was working.
That was working. Mine wasn't. And I asked him if he would please drive me to the dentist. I had to go to the dentist. I had a terrible toothache. And he did. And on our trip to the dentist, when he came and picked us up, I heard Jennifer Warnes, as they were promoting the play in Los Angeles, playing songs from the play. And Jennifer Warnes sang that song. And I told Timmy, I said, that's a hit record. I said, I got to get a hold of that record. And he said, well, when you're in the dentist office, I'll see if I can find it. And I said, great, that would be perfect. So when I came back, he said, no, he couldn't find it, but he will get it. So he did, and he brought it to the studio about a day or 3 days later, whatever it was.
So cruel, easy to be hard, easy to become. How can people have no feeling? How can they ignore their friends? Easy to be proud, easy.
Hi, this is Danny Hutton of Three Dog Night.
And Corey Wells of Three Dog Night.
And we're in the studio.
Well, you needed a couple of true believers, certainly, to make it happen, to get the major label deal. Who first was Lou Adler, and what was his rep, and producer Gabriel Meckler?
Lou Adler had formed Dunhill Records, but I think by the time we got the Dunhill Records, I think he sold out. Jay Lasker was the president. I think they kind of hooked up with ABC,
right.
So it became ABC Dunhill, and Lou kind of was, I mean, he's a guy that I knew. I think Corey did too. He was, he's a hot guy at the time, but I think he'd already gone by the time we were there.
Right. I think our first two albums were on Dunhill, and then they made the changeover to ABC Dunhill, and that's when they started to sign a lot of the old black artists and those people, like on VJ Records and those obscure record companies.
Yeah, and then Ray Charles came on the label, which is pretty cool. So.
Yeah, pretty cool. Well, time.
And that first album was done within 2 days.
No kidding.
We did one side a day.
Yeah.
One side.
It was all done live. It was all done live.
Yeah, everything was done, and then we'd put a few little, overdubs on it, but it was basically just, that's how we sounded. That album was kind of, we went and auditioned we went and played at the Troubadour, and Lasker just said, well, let's do it. And we said, great, and we're going to come up with more songs. And they went, no, that's... What we just heard will be your first album.
Wow!
I think, I think Gabriel maybe brought in one though. I remember him playing that for me, so I must have met him at his little place in West Hollywood.
Well, I know that Neil Young came in to play us his.
Yeah, the loner.
The loner at the Whiskey, and we were there rehearsing at the Whiskey, and he came in and he sat down with his guitar and started playing us this song and. What do you think, guys, this and that? And then I think he handed somebody a dub, or demo, as they call them. And we went from there.
Yeah.
I
still have that. I've got the cassette of that.
No, oh, really? Kidding. You still have that to this day?
Yeah.
That's right. eBay, look out. But I remember about that is I used to, Neil, he came in with like this little amp. And I used to say, God, does he get a great sound out of this little amp? It's a little Fender. Mm-hmm. And I helped him put it up there, and it must have weighed 500 pounds. It was so customized. It looks like, it was all beat up looking in the front, and it was probably a $2,000 amp.
Yeah, it had those heavy magnets on the speakers.
Yeah, but it was extra heavy.
That's
anyway,
a great story.
We ended up doing, I ended up doing Try a Little Tenderness live with the band in the studio with them around, standing around them and the whole thing.
Holding a mic in your hand.
And the hard thing about it was that if they screwed up, we'd have to start all over again. And, that's a pretty tough song, to keep doing over and over and over.
I'll say.
I think we did about six takes or something until we got it right.
Wow.
A whole six tapes? Six takes?
Well, live.
I know, I'm just saying, that's funny. People do 30 takes and then fix it.
Slipping away, sitting on a pillow, waiting for night to fall. Girl in a dream, sitting on a pillow, this is the night.
You're saying to the music. Celebrate, celebrate, dance to the music.
Danny, tell me how you got turned on to the song Celebrate, because you've already mentioned his name so far, and I certainly wanted to pick up on Danny Whitten.
Yeah, Danny Whitten. He was a neighbor. He was a great guy, and he's the guy that ended up, he was in a group called the Rockets, and then he ended up backing up Neil Young, really being the leader of a group called Crazy Horse that's now still with him. And he lived down the street. And used to go down and hang out with him. When we were doing the first album, you know, I used to go down there and talk to him, and he had a demo of from Bonner and Gordon of a song called Celebrate, and he gave it to me, and like I said, the problems we used to have before were there was four musicians, so we didn't want to overdub a lot of other musicians on our sessions. And he gave it to me, and it had all of these strings and horns and stuff. And I said, I love this song, but we're never going to be able to do this live. So I think we got back from tour, and we had, I think, 30 days after an exhausting tour, I think, to do a whole album. Guys, we got 30 days for you to find the songs, record them, and do the whole thing. So in a panic, I said, I brought it, played it for everybody. Everybody liked it. And then we just sat there and figured out how to.
We did end up asking some friends of ours at the time to play on it.
Oh yeah,
horn section from
these
Chicago.
Guys called CTA ended up being Chicago.
They were Chicago.
I know.
I mean, there was CTA, but we were working the same club, the Whiskey.
Yeah,
and we got to meet them there, and we asked them, "Hey, would you guys mind doing a session this and that?" And they said, "Yeah."
Yeah, they came down. They came down one night, and the trombone player. Pankow,
right.
Sat down and he listened to the end. It was like a vamp at the end, and he just wrote those charts amazingly fast. They were great.
Those must have been great days when
they
been a wonderful community of musicians then.
It was. It was a very tight-knit community of musicians who respected each other, and I'll talk about it for days also. I mean, it's to me, it is just nothing but wonderful memories.
Take my soul. That's what you said.
over the Christmas New Year's holiday, 1968. The first album's just coming out. You're booked to play the Miami Pop Festival in front of 100,000 people.
Etched very close into the brain.
I want to hear about it. Tell me about it, because you must have been completely unknown at the time. That's a tough gig.
Well, first of all, you have to know what we went through in order to get there, because we were playing a chain of nightclubs in Illinois called the Wild Goose nightclubs in Chicago area.
Outside of Chicago.
Outside.
It was not Chicago.
And we were promised so-and-so, and we promised us food after, and they brought us some steaks on a piece of bread or something. And we were going to try to get some sleep that night, and they had mattresses down in the basement on the floor. And we said, no, we're just going to hit the road and go. And we drove in station wagons to Miami from Illinois. And what a grueling, grueling trip. I mean, you'd wake up in the middle of the day and you go, where are we? And you know, Kentucky, and then you go back to sleep. And I mean, this went on until we got there, and then we had to do a show. But of course, we were all in our 20s.
I think it was an afternoon. I think we went on in the afternoon, too. I don't think we went on at night.
No.
I think Jimmy has a poster, found a poster, and it was amazing.
It was during the day.
But it was a day.
It was Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, Joni Mitchell, Canned Heat, Country Joe and the Fish, and Three Dog Night. Boy, that is a tough gig. And remind us, those of us who don't perform, the weakest link in PAs in those days were for the singers, and you had three lead singers.
Yeah, the systems were horrible.
Yeah.
They weren't set up.
They wouldn't be able to handle it. We had a little rinky-dinky setup that we used in the small clubs and places that we had with Skip Bennett, who took this stuff around, and it was space-age stuff. I remember it was
Bruce.
Yeah.
Bruce amps, which we used them, I believe, we used them at the Forum. These were little teeny, but they were really, really good quality. I was a brand-new company, so I think we probably sounded pretty good compared to a lot of the other groups.
If you were down front.
Exactly. I mean, it's relative.
Well, the company made avionics or some kind of thing for the space system. And this was like a side project for him.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog, was a good friend of mine.
Blue sea.
Hi, this is Danny Hutton of Three Dog Night.
And Corey Wells of Three Dog Night.
And we're in the studio.
And I'm Redbeard. Now, Danny and Corey agree with me that Jeremiah wasn't really a bullfrog and certainly wasn't a turkey.
Jeremiah was
a cash cow.
Was a cash cow.
It's whatever hooked the audience, and that was a visual picture for them, and they hooked on, they latched onto that big time.
Well, you know, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that was the third single, the last one off of that album. Whatever, was that the Naturally?
Off of Naturally, that's correct. That's correct.
Yeah, so, and we actually didn't... We didn't pick the singles. Well, I mean, usually you can tell the first song, first side is one we kind of thought we liked and might be the single. But we weren't like a singles band, although everybody laughs at that. Says, what do you mean you weren't a singles band? We went in to record an album of the songs that we loved, we did our best with, and then gave it to the public and said, you guys, you know, you choose.
Not even the record player did. I mean, the record company did that. He said, we would just give them the album, and they would release the album.
Yeah.
And then we would get, in those days, you'd get feedback from the disc jockeys.
Oh, do I remember those good old days. Yeah. Yes, I remember those days.
And they'd say, hey, you know, we're getting a lot of calls on this one song. Yeah. I don't know, you guys thinking about making that a single? We're all, nope, we're not thinking about making anything a single, but if you think so.
The cream would rise to the top, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Because, you know, that old thing, so many times somebody puts up one song on an album at the last minute because they don't have enough time, and they do it in 20 minutes, and it's the hit.
It's happened time and time again, hasn't it? It's just amazing how many times that has happened. So... This song that you guys didn't hear, didn't understand, and really didn't like, this Joy to the World, this Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog song, it was the biggest hit of the year 1971. It was the biggest hit for Three Dog Night. It was the biggest hit for Dunhill Records that they ever had. That is just
In the United States.
Yeah.
In England, Mama Told Me actually was the biggest.
Wow.
Our biggest song.
It had a second complete life of its own again in 1983 when the Big Chill movie comes out. It starts all over again. So, I mean, it's just been very, very good to you.
Yeah, and also we were nominated for the Grammys that year. And,
For
the Newest Artist, was it?
Yeah.
Newest Artist. And we were in contention with...
Carole King.
Oh,
my goodness.
Carpenters.
Oh.
Carpenters. And the Carpenters.
What incredible company to be with.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. That's just something.
Want some whiskey in your water, sugar in your tea? What's all this crazy question they're asking me? This is the craziest party that could ever be. Don't turn on the lights, cause I don't want to see. Mama told me not to come. From the smell of stale perfume, and that cigarette you're smoking, I'll scare me half to death. Open up the window, sucker. Let me catch my breath. Mama told me not to come. Mama told me not to come. That ain't the way to have fun, son. That ain't the way to have fun.
She's a
Mama told me not to come. Mama told me not to come. She said that ain't the way to have fun, son. That ain't the way to have fun. No, Mama knows how.
Danny, that summer, you're on tour in Europe. How did you hear the song Black and White?
Well, it was a hit, I think, in Holland, and I think maybe England. And I heard it at a hotel on the TV. I was with a guy named Stevie, our agent, young Stevie. Barnett, Steve Barnett, who is now
he did manage
Stevie
for AC/DC.
Barnett,
yeah.
He was AC/DC's
manager.
He's
president of Epic now.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Well, young Stevie was about 17 years
old.
I don't think he even signed contracts. But wild man. Anyway, we went to Holland together.
He's on the wagon now.
I heard just the end chorus, and I loved it. And then we were... were we all in Europe together? We were in Europe, and that was the last of it. We came back to the States, and I thought, well, that's going to be a big hit. And I had the record, and one of our sessions, I think we waited 6 months. And in those days, records could fall through the cracks, you know, MTV and all of that. If you put out a record, everybody knows about it if it's a hit. And it was kind of unknown, and in the States, it didn't make it. So. We went in and did it.
Are you familiar with the history of the song, Black and White?
I became familiar with it way later. I had no idea at the time. I mean, I had no idea there was probably 6 or 7 verses to sets of verses on the song.
The ink is black, the page is white. Together we learn to read and write. A child. Black, the child is white. The whole world looks upon a sight, a beautiful sight. And now a child can understand that this is the law of all the land. The world is black.
I just did some research and found out that the song was written like around 1950, 56,
yeah,
and
civil
it was
rights.
And it was based on a 1954 civil rights ruling with the Supreme Court. So it's not even a, if you will, a contemporary, like a 70s song even.
Right,
and,
right.
So it has a wonderful civil rights history to it.
Yeah, but we in no way did it for that reason.
No, it's just a great pop song.
It's a great sentiment, though. But we weren't. Yeah. You know, I think it is. It has a great. It has a nice uplifting message. But I was going to say, Alan Arkin, the actor. His father was a co-writer of that song.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now see,
Alan Arkin actually was. Was a writer. I think he wrote.
I did not know that.
I think he wrote.
He wrote letters to his mom, didn't he?
When we did the basic track, that had a great. It had a very unique kind of a thing. I don't think there was a lot of call out kind of a fast reggae.
I was just going to say. I was just ready to say that. I don't think reggae was not in then.
Yeah.
And we were. I think we were one of the very first that were doing a reggae.
Good point. And Corey. Tell how you got another great Hoyt Axton song, the story about getting Never Been to Spain.
We were off during that period of time, thank God, and I went up to see Hoyt in Oregon, and I decided I was going to hunt and fish my whole way up there, well, at least fish. And I went to one of the rivers that are there in Redding, or just outside of Redding, and caught a steelhead and brought that up to Hoyt, and we had smoked steelhead, And he said, well, we'll have that for dinner tonight. And so dinner time came, and he brought some wine out.
He set you up, right?
He set me up big time.
Have a little more wine.
He had this. He was living in a lodge near the Umpqua River in Oregon, in Idlewild Park. And he lived in a home that was a hunting lodge in the 1920s. And he had this gigantic fireplace that I was told, I don't know if it was true or not, but it had a stone in the fireplace from every country in the world, or close to.
What?
So, yeah. And so, and he had this roaring fire going. He had this wine on the table. He had cheese. He had crackers. He had all this stuff. And we had the smoked steelhead, and we're sitting there, and we're eating this food and enjoying it, and it's starting to snow outside, and it's... And it's just picture perfect, you know, from a like a postcard, and I'm drinking wine now. I don't drink, so it doesn't take much for me to start feeling
loving the world. He's a good drunk. Yeah. He starts to love everybody.
I love everybody, and of course Hoyt, you know, he realizes this, recognizes this, reaches behind the couch. Like Stevie Ray Vaughan in his video, and pulls out this guitar and starts singing, I got this song for you, Corey, I want you to listen to. And he plays me this thing, and I was like already inebriated and going, yeah, I love it. And I did, and I did like it. And then I took it back with me to Los Angeles and cut it.
Well, I never been to Spain, but I kinda like the music. See, the ladies are insane there, and they sure know how to use it. They don't abuse it, never gonna lose it. I can't refuse it. Well, I never been to England, but I kinda like. What?
Hi, this is Danny Hutton of Three Dog Night.
And Corey Wells of Three Dog Night.
And we're in the studio.
What do you guys have to say about this American Idol phenomenon?
First of all, I don't put myself in the place of the judges, but I put myself in place of the contestants.
Okay.
And I would, first of all, I don't know why anybody would want to subject themselves to that kind of treatment about their talent. I mean, to go through, I mean, there are some people who deserve it. I agree. But even still, though, to treat people that way. And I have no idea what the attraction is to humiliate somebody on TV. I wouldn't do it. I certainly would not do it, no matter what happens. I mean, I know what I'm capable of doing, and I know I don't need anybody to judge me in how I do it. I don't think Paula Abdul, where's her credentials? I mean, she lip syncs. I mean, she doesn't even sing, and when she does, she's buried in about 9 or 10 or different overdubs. And the English guy, it's show business.
I like him.
I know, but it's show business. He's using it as a vehicle to get popularity, and it's working, and he knows it works.
Well, this Danny, what I resent is I resent the ageism. There's no reason why. I think there's a cutoff age. I just know guys in L.A. that are 35 or 40 that could just sing circles around some
of these.
We
all do.
I know. And that kills me. There's some kind of a thing in Simon's head, I think, where they've got to be this word idol. They've got to look a certain way, be a certain age. And I don't like that. And I get a little bit tired of some of the vocal gymnastics. I mean, they're great. There's talented singers, but they tend to have about 80% of kind of black church gospel.
And you're being conservative when you say 80%.
Yeah, and it's constantly that kind of sound, but they're fabulous, and they could riff forever. But there's a certain sameness where I'm hearing kind of another Whitney Houston, you know, another some, you know, a black male singer, and I'm kind of hearing the same sound. And also, it would be nice once in a while if somebody sat at the piano and played, or had a guitar. You know, look, like Bob Dylan. There's so many people that never ever could be on that show because of they've got this certain little musical ghetto they kind of have everybody in.
Thank you.
The other thing that's unfair, I think, is the fact that they make these young kids sing songs that are 35 years before they were even born.
Right.
To sing those kind of songs,
right.
And I think that's unfair to them.
I agree.
They should be singing their songs, of today. But see, that would put the judges in a predicament because they wouldn't have anything to judge it against.
Boy, you've nailed all the. You're going right down my list. You're nailing all the things I have a problem with. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I like watching it. I do watch it. I don't know how they can do this phone thing though. I mean, how that's fair. I don't know how they monitor it.
I'm with Corey. I don't get it. Okay.
But we're talking about it, aren't we?
Just an old-fashioned love song playing on the radio. Wrapped around the music is the sound of someone promising they'll never go. You swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on. No need in bringing them back cause they're never really gone.
Just an old-fashioned love song, one I'm sure they wrote for. An old-fashioned love song coming down in three-part harmony.
To weave our dreams upon and listen to each evening
underscore our love affair with tenderness and feeling that we've come to know. You swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on and on. No need in bringing them back cause they're never really gone.
Just an old-fashioned love song.
Until recently, let's say the first 4 years of the 21st century, the record business has been crying crocodile tears, saying the sky is falling. You guys have opinions on the record business problems of low sales, although it seems like it's been improving in the last year to 18 months. But, you know, we've seen everything from the RIAA suing consumers to wanting Congress to, put legislation in place. We've seen everything in the world except what I see as the problem. You guys got any opinions on what's wrong with the record business?
Well, I think technology plays a big part in all that. I think it's moving ahead faster than they can make rules of the game for them. I mean, you know, this now downloading songs off the internet and swapping songs and this and that. They don't know how to get a handle on it. They don't know how this can be stopped in order to stop sales. I think in the industry itself, in the recording industry, I think the technology has also opened up the floodgates for people who really can't sing, who cannot sing, and the technology is now allowing them to sound like they are great singers because they have the ability. By doing so, this guy who's a mediocre singer and so forth, so he gets in the studio and they tweak his voice, and when he's sharp, they make him on, and when he's flat, they make him down. And the guy comes out singing like Caruso, and then but when he goes on, but the acid test is when he goes on tour and he has to sing on stage. Now he can't duplicate that on stage, so what is he doing? He's lip syncing on stage. All the Britney Spears and all of it. And their excuse is, well, we have to dance, we'd be out of breath. But, you know, I don't know.
On the CD level, I'm a little confused because I know about the downloading and all of that. But what I have a problem with is when we recorded our songs 30, 35 years ago, it was an expensive situation. It was a big deal to go into the studio and get the studio time and do all of that stuff. Nowadays, kids can be in their bedroom and for $500 or whatever, $1,000, they can record a pretty good, well, done studio, you know, CD. So for them to go and download, have their songs downloaded, I don't know how much they're losing, but for old guys like us, that is a problem for me. It's our legacy, and it kind of bothers me when it's when there's no fee, the illegal stuff. On the other hand, I think I see the points where it's good for young guys to put a couple of tracks up there and have people download and get their career going. You know, so I'm a little torn both ways.
So let me see if I understand this right, Danny. What you're saying is that there was, in the past, there was an entry fee that kind of kept the mediocre semi-professionals
out. You got it.
Out, yeah. And mm-hmm. it kept this entry fee.
And the high risk.
And the high risk kept the cream, only the cream of the crop could get mm-hmm. into the highest levels of professional showbiz.
You had to pay your dues.
You had to pay
usually,
your dues.
You had to be around a long time before you could finally get a record deal, and
right.
then there was a lot of money invested,
right.
and a lot of work involved. And now a kid can be in his bedroom in two nights for $1,000. There he is. I don't care if you download my crap, guys.
Yeah, well, but it also hurts the younger musicians who had some success, mm-hmm. who don't have the backing that we had. Mm-hmm. But people downloading their songs, they like them, they download their songs, they're not getting any money for it.
I know.
It's unfair to them because they haven't had 30 years to accumulate an income like we have. They're just starting out. They're trying to get some kind of... Mm-hmm. income, and even the little income that they make is being downloaded. You know?
So if I understand you right, what you're saying is that overall, this is lowering the bar or watering everybody down. And so in the long run, this may not be a good thing for everybody.
I don't think so. Like I said before, technology is moving faster than we can make laws to keep up with it.
Wash away my troubles, wash away my pain, with the rain and shone by love. Wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame, with the rain and shone by love. Oh, ooh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, ooh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Shambhala.
That's perfect. You guys were real champs. I really enjoyed this very, very much.
Thank you, Redbeard. You're very, very interesting interviewer.
Thanks, guys.
Very good. You pulled some good stuff out of
it. It was my pleasure, and it was very interesting, and I'm so glad we got to do this.
Okay, all right, great.
Thank you, Redbeard.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Bye.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Bye.